When asked what a cinematographer does, he speaks in tongues. His home movies have been submitted to the Library of Congress for their cultural significance. It's called an Oscar because he declined to use his name. He is the most interesting DP in the world.
I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I prefer Make Me Watch. Stay tuned, my friends.
Welcome to Make Me Watch. We are a couple of failed filmmakers who are forever students of cinema on an eternal quest to watch more movies. I'm your host, E, and I'm joined by my co-host, who doesn't need a guitar to bring up the sun, Sean McGee. How are you, brother?
I've been trying for years to learn that song. I'm doing great. I'm excited. We have a very special guest with us today.
Nice to be here. Thank you, guys. It is no snow here, Sean. So
I know. I'm jealous. Yeah, I had to bring that up just to like get in the mindset of this this movie that we're going to talk about later, because it is the opposite vibe that I'm feeling right now as I'm snowed in here.
We're here to talk about opera, essentially. And opera has a fixed set of aesthetics, right, that is preserved in amber, perfected and sealed in time. But the two films we're talking about today are what happens when art and traditions refuse to stay still. One takes us inside of Turandot, as reimagined by Ai Weiwei, where an opera written a century ago becomes a live act of protest, confrontation, and risk. The other brings us to Casaverde in Milan, a retirement home for opera singers, where voices once trained for grandeur now live alongside memory, ritual, and the passing of knowledge from one generation to the next. At first glance, these two projects couldn't feel more different. One is loud, political, and contemporary. The other is an intimate, patient, and quietly radical documentary. But together, they ask the same questions. What responsibilities does art have to history, to society, and to the people who carry it forward? Our guest today is the connective tissue between these two questions. Christine Lamont is a multi-hyphenate, talented producer, director, writer, and former Universal Disney and Orion film marketing executive. Founder and president of Lamont Productions, who has not one but two Oscar-qualifying films in the awards circuit that we've just mentioned. Her work sits at the intersection of culture, politics, and process. Her two Oscar-qualifying documentaries, Ai Weiwei's Turandot and Via Verde, don't just observe artists, they examine what it means to make art in public, under pressure, and in media res. Christine Lamont, thank you so much for joining us. Can we call you Christine during the episode?
Yes, of course. Eric, thank you. Beautiful introduction. You got both those films perfectly. They could not have been better marketing-wise. Thank you very much.
No worries. Thank you. Very nice. Christine, before, like I mentioned, we're going to bring back an old, you're unaware of this, and some of the guests that are joining us for the first time, one of the smartest things Sean did with his show was cut out our top three segment, which when we would cover a film, we would ask at the top of the episode a question and present three films that were germane to the film that we were covering. We're going to bring that segment back, a little bit of our top three, and we're going to ask you three questions apiece about these two films that are most pertinent to us. Now, I've covered a lot of your interviews and listened to some of your interview on the Jeremiah show, and I've been reading things on you. So I'm very curious to ask you questions and get your response on things that you maybe haven't been asked during this award circuit. But before we do that, we want to kind of start with some zero questions. I lied. I'm going to maybe ask you five here. But the first thing I'd like to ask you is, what's credited on IMDb are two documentaries that are back-to-back, via Via Verde in 2024 and Ai Weiwei in 2025. What do you credit this creative spark that you're on to? Like, these two documentaries, and then you have a third that I'm understanding here that is in post-production. I'm curious, like, this is a creative fervor right here in these last 3-4 years. What do you credit this to?
What do I connect it to?
Credit this to, like, this
Well, I grew up with opera, number one, right? My grandmother would be making sauce. I remember as a young girl, she'd be making sauce on Saturday for Sunday for all of us. All of the cousins and aunts got together on Sunday for Sunday sauce. And in the background would be Mara Lanza singing these arias, whether it was Verdi or Puccini. So it's kind of in my blood. And I come from an Italian family who loved opera. And a culture and tradition of Italy loves opera. So I feel it's been my DNA. And then as I grew up, and always went to opera. I was lucky enough when I was working at Universal, when La Traviata was there, I was the person who did most of the marketing for it. Jim Katz started Universal Classic, and he had all these great films like Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, and Zoot Suit, and this as well. It was the beginning of the classic that ended up at Sony Classics. So I did a lot of the marketing for it because I understood opera. And I became close to Zeffirelli because he was, Rocco Zeffirelli was the director. So he would invite me to all of his rehearsals at the Met. I was very fortunate to have kind of to have him take me under his wing and have maybe a more proper education. So the arts have always been important to me. And music has always driven my life and my world in a way. So I guess that was some of the spark. And then I was living in Italy and going to a lot of theater and opera. I was called by Ivan Russo, who was a friend. We've had a 30-year friendship, and this has been a 13-year journey for us. And I was living in Italy, in Rome, and she reached out to say, I've got this great project. I'd love you to be involved in it. It's Verdi, it's Milan, and it's an older generation of Italians. I said, that sounds like my world, totally. I would love to be involved. So we produced it and wrote it together, and she directed it. So very lucky. And Concentric Circles, Maxime Derevenko, who's the director of Ai Weiwei's Turandot, was in Rome. I helped him with one of his film projects. He was 21 at the time. And so when I went up to Milan to film Viva Verdi, I said, Maxime, you've got to come up and be our cameraman. He came up, right. He was our cameraman, which was so beautiful. And then he's so talented. And then when he went back, he became the video and film head for the Rome Opera. Yeah. And so he got involved with Ai Weiwei 7 years later and said, you've got to produce this with me. So it's all these concentric circles of working with people that I, first-time directors too. It's been an exciting thing to put my energy towards, and to my life work and my career, my decades-long career, been lucky and fortunate enough to be able to use all of that to make this happen. These two films pop right now, and to be on the Academy portal is very exciting for us.
That's really cool. I was gonna say, the way that like the momentum kind of builds into everything like that, where it's like not only the culmination of like so much of your experience and work, but then to like the people that you meet on one flowing into the next one is just like, you know, that's just how this industry always seems to work. But it's just a beautiful thing.
No, it's like, really interesting, Sean, because you never know about films like life. They happen. So when I was working on Viva Verdi, obviously it was 2012, 2013, and it was years later that Ai Weiwei was commissioned to do this opera. So, you know, I didn't know what was in front of me, but things happen, and it just worked out that both these films are on the portal. But I look at it as a celebration of the tradition of opera and art. That's how beautiful that the Academy and Academy members are embracing this art form.
Yeah, yeah. Even the story of that getting made like reflects that the stories that they're telling of like this like multi-generational, multi-art form, like hyphenates all coming together on a project. That's really cool.
It's such a beautiful thing to see in 2025, to think that opera's still alive and is accessible and reachable, and that the torch is being passed down to the next generation, so that they can keep this art form alive and vital. And Ai Weiwei taking a, you know, over 100-year-old opera and modernize it, and again making it accessible to an audience that is hungry for more meaningful fare.
Absolutely. I'd like to actually jump in here with and getting started with Ai Weiwei and sort of my reaction to it.
I'm not interested in opera at all. Normally, I don't listen to music. My Turandot is going to be different.
This is our director, Ai Weiwei. He's been called the most powerful figure in contemporary art.
I know Ai Weiwei as a free speech magnate, as a freedom fighter.
This is a perfect story about China.
China is not a free country.
Poche ore fa il governo ha definito delle regole alle quali ovviamente noi non possiamo non sottostare, quindi dobbiamo chiudere il teatro fino alla fine di marzo. Non si possono fare più le prove.
Always say the work is like my home. So it's like suddenly you build the home, it collapsed. Why I will we have to do a tour on that? You know, what is my interpretation of the show?
No one has ever done a Turandot that's about the world today as it is so directly. Every detail, every costume, every prop has been designed new. Nothing is the way it ever usually looks.
Oh, I was Turandot, of course, related his work and his life. The concept of his artwork is definitely related to Turandot.
I think the art compete with reality, and art will give the last words.
I have to admit to Sean, and I'll admit to you, Christine, I was not familiar with Ai Weiwei before this documentary, so I am appreciative and love that to not only get familiar with his journey, but what he was bringing to this project. One of the things immediately that struck me when I watched the documentary was Ai Weiwei, by his own admission, feels like the wrong person on the job on the surface of it. He admits that he doesn't like opera or music, or at least opera music, I should say. I was curious to ask you, because I know, like, I love hip hop, I love rap, and it would be curious for me to imagine somebody coming into that field, that culture, and saying, I want to make a rap album, but I not only do I not like rap, I don't like the music, and I'm going to make some very radical changes to that for my project. Were you at all, you or your team at all, concerned about the execution of this project or what you might look to kind of capture?
Never, Eric, because when you're working with someone like Ai Weiwei, an artist who's an iconoclast, who breaks images, who is not as loves challenges, isn't fearless about going forward in any medium, on any format, that's an exciting thing. We're all activists. We understood that Ai Weiwei is an activist first and foremost. He's a humanitarian, like Verdi, actually. They're both humanitarian first before they're artists. So, no, we understood what we were getting into and embraced it wholeheartedly. So this was Ai Weiwei's opera for peace. Mm-hmm. And we all understood where it could potentially go. And so we, as I said, we embraced it and we're very excited working with Marta Zaccarone, who's my producing partner on this. It was a really wonderful experience, delicious in every way. And then bringing on Andy Cohen as a producer. He worked with Ai Weiwei on some other films as executive producer. And then Andy brought on his friend Julian Lennon, who's his executive producer, is a very, you know, a big activist. And then I brought on Marcy Pullier, who's a friend, as an EP, another activist. So, as I said, we all understood where we were going and embraced it full force and brought to the table whatever we needed to, whether it was patience and understanding during COVID and then moving forward and raising whatever we had to for funds to keep going. Yeah.
With bringing all those people together from all those different like industries and disciplines and everything, especially with this being like that intersection of activism and opera, and then obviously Ai Weiwei has experience in filmmaking itself. So you had other like film producers in there. I'm curious, especially as this has gotten like awards consideration now, what is the audience that you seem to have found, or that this documentary has found between those communities?
It's really interesting with Ai Weiwei, because he obviously has a huge following on his social media. There's millions of people that follow him, and they know him as an artist. They know him as a director of his own films, his own documentaries. So it's that, it's the opera fans, it's the art fans, it's new documentary lovers who understand that this could be an unfolding, understanding his process. And for me, it's really an installation. There were only 8 days of performances for this opera. It will never happen again. Ai Weiwei will never ever do opera again. He likes to do what he's not good at, so he can bring his art to that and his political stance to those things. So that will never happen. So I feel like we were able to give an audience, these fans of Ai Weiwei, these people that are eager to see anything that he touches, anything that he has to say, a way to understand his process, his creative process, how he works with collaborators, conversations that he has to move things forward, to have an intimate look at the costumes that he creates, the set design, the projections that he had, the video projections. So it's a gift. I think it's a gift that we were able to give. And also there's, Rai did an entire filming of the opera. So you can see that too as a kind of a bookend. You can see the entire opera and then see this as the process and the intimate process behind that.
I really love the way that was structured in the documentary, where it like you have that like opening bookend to kind of refamiliarize, because it's a story that you've like probably heard, like absorbed in a lifetime of the arts, but maybe like but just like that, like kind of refresher up top. And then after going through that creative process of all the struggles with the costuming and the explanation of the way that the like production design and everything, and then to get that little cap at the end too, to refresh it. I really enjoyed the structure of it. It was nice.
Thank you. That was the genius of Maxine, that we worked together to create that flow, that rhythm, to find that spine of the film. We had an embarrassment of riches with archival, you can imagine, with Ai Weiwei. And Ai Weiwei was generous enough to give us his beautiful background and archival footage that we used. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit of a challenge. You know, how much do you put in? How much do you take out?
Yeah.
Find that balance. But I think we did a good job of understanding Ai Weiwei, especially since we go and show a bit of his father, who was a poet and artist, and also that he was exiled with his father at a young age. And Maxime, I think the reason why they were very close and there was a great intimacy with them, because Maxime comes from a family where art has been challenged, because his father was a Russian ballet Bolshoi dancer. And fell in love with an Italian woman.
Maxime, correct.
Maxime Derevenko, the director of Ai Weiwei's Turandot. So when he was he left Russia so that he could marry his love, his Italian bride. And so Maxime understood the idea of art being challenged in the world and in a country that would do that. So I think there was some simpatico with them. They understood each other. And I think that's kind of why Ai Weiwei embraced and was able to give Maxime access, intimate access.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, was there a moment you ever felt pressure from funders or distributors or collaborators to like soften or amplify the political messaging in Ai Weiwei's Turandot? Was there an argument you guys had behind the scenes or pressures you guys had to make it fit one pocket or another when bringing this film out to market?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Eric, because the people who are supposed to be on the film are on the film. And I'm sure there were some people that maybe questioned and were a little bit, had some trepidation. Mm-hmm. But the people that came on board embraced it wholeheartedly and wanted to be a part of a movement, you know, this opera for peace, that would really make people question, you know, their belief system, and hopefully, you know, be food for thought and for change. And that's what is. But of course, there are people that are more conservative in their views that were afraid to upset the status quo. But not any of us that are involved in this film. We're all about upsetting the status quo.
I love it. Sure.
Hell yeah. That's awesome.
Can we transfer to Via Verde?
Sure.
Hello!
I am Carmen Gerosa. I'm from Italy, from Milano. I am a volunteer in this house. The only thing to come here, you must be a musician.
Alle Prandettina, dal 27 giugno del 1920.
Pronto? I'm Anthony Kaplan. Pronto? I sang as Antonio Riscia.
Since when it grows and smells.
If you see that somewhere in the world, you remember that's me.
I'm 82 years old. I'm singer and pianist.
Il mio nome è Leonello.
Perché effettivamente rispetto a loro sono più giovane.
Io mi chiamo Lina Vasta. Nella mia cantiera sono cantante lirica.
Casa Verdi è unica al mondo. Yep. Yep.
Yep. La tavola è il momento più importante della giornata.
Not only a house for old people, but there's a mixture of young and old.
Dimmi lavorare il suolo.
The body is old, the mind is young.
Vorrei ancora poter indicare qualche percorso, qualche strada.
Great to be surrounded by music.
Creatività sia un elemento di grande importanza per invecchiare il più tardi possibile.
Vorrei poter ancora dire qualche cosa.
Soltanto aspettare questo è troppo triste, vero? Io ho qualche speranza ancora.
Grazie, Verdi. Sei stato grande.
Viva Verdi!
Pronto? I don't know what's happening. Pronto? Shut.
I'd love to talk to you about the residents here are living legacies, and I'm very curious, and I love their stories. I'm going to get into Claudio here in a bit, but was there an ethical line you drew about editing intimate and possibly, you know, sentimental moments in this that would either romanticize or objectify sort of the aging performers? Were you concerned at all? Like, what line are we drawing to tell their stories that feel in line with the spirit of what they're trying to get across, but maybe we can soften this or perhaps we'd like to amplify this? What were some of these lines in terms of the life stories that these people were trying to draw?
Yeah, to be honest with you, we gave full, you know, full approach to these stories. Mm-hmm. And there were a few people that we started with that either passed on or had to go, because we did three shoots. So there was time in between. So there were arcs with these characters, and there were a few that we wanted to follow that either ended up in the Alzheimer's ward, you know, or had passed on. Because when you start with people when they're 91, inevitable that these things happen. So we just had to pivot a little bit. And then we focused on these five subjects that characters that we fell in love with. There were so many there that you could imagine, right? There were so many beautiful stories, but the ones that we followed were, I'm sorry.
I'm not going to lie to you. Just, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that was, that. It made me upset in a good way at the end of the documentary, because at the end we show, you know, the people are in, where I was like, oh, please don't make me fall in love with these people. Then tell me they're no longer. That hurts a little bit at the end there. But yeah.
You know what? That's just the truth of life. Life happens, and there are these cycles, and they're inevitable. So you show the beauty, the youth of these incredible opera singers and performers that were able to have these robust, incredible lives in the arts, and then how they were able to become residents at Casa Verdi when they started, and then how they have been passing the torch to a younger generation. Yes. And what a fulfilling life. What could be better than that, than to live with kindred spirits who are obsessed with music like you are, whether they're young or old. So there they are jamming it in 91 and 85. And there they are with younger students walking arm in arm, talking about philosophy, life, about music. And the way Massimiliano and the film says, you just can't get this in books. It's only a Casa Verdi. And we really hope that this will be a blueprint for other retirement homes and for everybody's home, that you can appreciate an elder generation that has gifts to pass on to you, and that you would share your vitality and your youth and your curiosity with them. That's a win-win. That is the beauty of life. And that's the way, I'm sure it's many before we entered this very modern stage of all of us being on our phones and our iPad, that's the way it was. I remember growing up with my grandparents, and I was at my grandfather's feet all the time, listening to stories about Sicily and what he did as a youth. And it was kind of half Italian, half English, but I got it because it was heartfelt and it came directly, you know, in a soulful way. And all of us can identify with that, I'm sure, with your grandmothers, right? Mm-hmm. And your grandparents. Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of both these films. They're universal. But Viva Verdi especially speaks to the heart about that. Yes. Because we all have, it's a universal thing that we grow up with these generations.
Yeah, I think what was really special to me about like Viva Verde, it succeeds at just like not just documenting these people's stories, but really like highlighting that connection with the community. And like you said, the way that they're like given the opportunity to pass the torch to these students that you get introduced to as well, I think is like my favorite part of the whole documentary. Like, I was curious, was that something that you knew was going to be a focus going in, or was that something that you found in production?
Oh, no, absolutely. That was the uniqueness of the home, that one of the things we wanted to show. I mean, number one, that Verdi was, as I said, a humanitarian first, and he was such a philanthropist and a lover of the common man. He identified as a farmer. If you asked him what he did, he said he was a farmer, and those were his roots. But he created this home for his fellow artists that weren't as lucky, because there were no pensions at the time. So some of those artists had nowhere to go. So in every room, there are little altars to Verdi. Mm-hmm. And it's such a beautiful thing to see, because everyone's so grateful to have this safe haven at this stage in life, where you don't have to think about cooking, you don't have to think about money to pay the electricity, that it's there. I mean, there's a sliding scale that people give, but Verdi was a brilliant man. He had a corporate headset, a business headset, as well as the artistic side. And so he was able to build apartments around Casa Verdi, and the rent from those, as well as the grants and the donations that are given to him that keep the home alive and going.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask, in relation to Via Verde, as someone who's transitioning from a major studio marketing background into producing indie docs, what old studio habit did you keep that sort of surprised your collaborators in this
adventure? That's a very interesting question, Eric, because I am a studio head first and foremost. And I'm working in an independent production world, and I bring this strict very strict rules that I grew up and was trained in the studio world. And it's very good because the film is more successful because of that. But it's often challenging to people who have not worked at the studio level. Right. So when I come in and I say, okay, this is our log line, this is our synopsis, it will stay that way until it will stay that way. And everybody in the film must use this. It cannot change, because once it changes, it is picked up by other press people and other people, and then it gets murky. So you want to keep the log line. This is our poster, and it will stay with us until we open and we decide to change it. This is the way we're going to do things. These are the bios. It has to be written in a certain form. I'm a little bit of a strict person about those things, because it's a professional way to approach things, and it's the way it should be done. There's no doubt about it. So, but I also bring a lot of strategic secrets with me that I learned working for decades, you know, and having back-to-back Oscar sweeps at Orion with Dances in Silence.
Silence of the Lambs, I want to ask you about.
Exactly. But there are certain ways to do things, and there are certain times to go against the grain. And one case in point is, you know, the voting started this week. It started, what was the 8th, right? It goes this week for the shortlist. Now, tradition would have it that you would have all your screenings before so that the voting members can see them and be prepared. I don't think so. I think that you could have one Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday of this week, because nobody votes until Friday. Nobody I know votes until the last minute. So there's an excitement and there's a free playing field. So the Japanese film and Joshua Jason, who's a brilliant marketer, did exactly that. And he had a screening for Kokuho, which is a Japanese entry, which is a brilliant, brilliant, incredible film about Kabuki. Mm-hmm. And he had it Wednesday night, and there were 55 Academy members there. Wow. So that's what I'm saying. There are little ways you can do things. And when you're a studio educated and trained, you can take a risk, because they understand you can do these things, and because you have a whole landscape in front of you, and you map it out and market it out. Right. So, but not all of your independent people that you work with are trust that. They don't they don't trust it. So, but whatever, you know, I do my best in guiding and giving.
Do they want to get started earlier? Like, would they rather you screen?
Well, no, of course. We've done a lot of screenings, but you know, there was one screening that we could have done this week that I had said, don't be afraid to do that, because this is a really good week, because Friday is when they vote. Nobody votes before that. Everybody waits until the last day. Right. So you have an opportunity.
It's like a freer
playing field. Right. And a few publicists took advantage of it, and it paid off, is what I'm saying. So it's just an interesting thing when you're a marketer, as in a producer, you're bringing your marketing skills. That's a very big deal to bring, because not all producers understand those specific timing, the timing and the strategy involved. Mm-hmm. So I think that I love that I'm able to bring my life experience in opera and other things, as well as my decade-long experience of being a strategist in the corporate world of film.
It's like Verde, like you were saying, like you got to balance that, like the corporate side of it, so that you can create something beautiful. Like it takes the both hands to do it.
I want to ask you one last question here from me before we transition into Black Orpheus. If you had to build a one, maybe a possibly two song playlist to prep somebody for each film, what song or specific track would you pick and why? Like, what songs do you feel like would represent or prepare a listener for Awe Way's Turn of Dog and Via Verde?
which song would I suggest?
Yeah, recommend. Like, if you were creating a playlist for this, so we'll see direct, like James Gunn, for instance, for his newest film, will create, here's a 12-track playlist I was listening to while writing the film, and this is what got me inspired, and this is the music that sort of, different directors may do that. If you were to pick one or two tracks from your own personal life as you were working on this or getting inspired by the stories, what track or two would you like to share with us that we can maybe share with our audience that would help prepare them for?
Well, for either one of them, it really would be the work of Puccini and the work of Verdi, because their work is very iconoclastic and very unique and different. But Verdi was actually, when Verdi died, Puccini took over for Verdi. Mm-hmm. So in the canon of opera. So it's a very interesting thing. So I guess for me, I would just listen to as much Verdi as possible. He used nature. He used nature a lot. Really? That's what influenced him. And there's a really beautiful story that Ivan really loved, the director, Ivan Russo, of the film, and my producing partner. She loved natural sounds. And Nick Pike, who beautifully wrote Sweet Dreams of Joy for the film, said, you know, I am going to research the birds of Parma to see which birds influenced him. And so he listened to the birds and found one bird that was very similar. So he had those bird sounds. And then we went segued right into some of Verdi's music when we went into the villa.
Right.
So knowing more of his work, and to me, La Traviata is kind of the theme that we use throughout, but knowing his other work, we were able to glean and take more of those pieces and use them. Mm-hmm. So that's for me. I'm sorry. It's just opera all the way.
That's what we wanted.
That's what I wanted.
For Puccini too. I mean, Tosca is one of my favorite operas. So, you know, getting ready for these, listening to opera all the time is such a gift. And all these years I've been able to work and do my favorite thing, which is listen to opera. So it's joyful. A very joyful thing.
Well, we've got one more gift on the show. We're covering 1959's Black Orifice. It's Christine's pick for the week. We thank you so much for bringing this film to the table here. We're going to give our overall thoughts up top without spoiling and then dive into the film with our world famous segments that break down the plot, performance, and our favorite behind the scenes stories. So without further ado, let's get into our review of 1959's Black Orifice.
Mágico? Porque fala? Mas todos os violões são mágicos. Eles cantam. E não somente os dos cantores. Meu dono nem é cantor. É um condutor de bonde da grande cidade. Que vai casar-se com uma garota muito bonita. Eu não gosto dela. E que se apaixona por uma pequena do interior. Tão diferente. Isso acontece todo dia. Como todos gostam dele, seus amigos vão todos ajudá-lo. Jovens e velhos, ricos e pobres, grandes e pequenos. Isso vai causar muitas pequenas comédias. E talvez mesmo um grande drama. É uma história de amor muito simples. De todos os tempos e de todos os países.
All right, that was from the trailer in 1959's Black Orpheus, logline a retelling of Orpheus and Eurydice's myth, set during the time of the Carnival in Rio de Janeiro, directed by Marcel Camus. Did I say that correctly? Okay. Shot by Jean Bourgeon, written by Jacques Viot. This is starring Breno Mello as Orfeo, Marpessa Dawn as Eurydice, Lourdes de Oliveira as Mira, and Leah Garcia as Serafina. As always, we start up top in our spoiler-free section with the titular question. Now for our guest, Christine, why did you make us watch this movie?
This film is my favorite film in the world. I also love Viva Verdi and Ai Weiwei's Turned Out, obviously. Right. But this film is a stunning retelling of the myth, of the Greek myth of Orfeo and Orfeo. And it has color, it has magic, it has Sugarloaf right there at the feet. And it's a film that I can see anytime, and it makes me it inspires me. It brings me hope. And it's about a romantic story. So it has all the elements that I love. And it goes into the underground. And so it has a little bit of this kind of not a spiritual or otherworldly mm-hmm. Aspect to it. And it was the birth of Bossa Nova. Yes. So Jobim wrote this music. And what's interesting, I have to tell you,
please.
When I was interviewing in Viva Verdi and really Clarinino, who's from mm-hmm. Brazil, and I said, Clarinino, tell me about what you do. And he said, well, I was one of the dancers in Black Orpheus. And I was crazy. And we started to sing da 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 da. And it was one of the best moments of my life. I'm not kidding you. To meet someone who created that. This film has such joy and passion, and the samba, the dancing. Is stunning. The acting is incredible. The editing, the cinematography is off the charts. And it was made 75 years ago. That's what's incredible about it. But anytime that you see this film, it was Academy Award winner in 1960 for Best Foreign Film. And it remains to me one of the best films still that I can see over and over again and never tire of it, especially because it has this youthful, these young kids that watch as Orfeo brings the sun up every morning, and when he's gone, they continue. Makes me cry.
Sean, did you want to follow up with your reaction? You want me to?
It was just like you said, like it, this movie is so timeless, and I think it is that like mix of the classical retelling of this, you know, obviously legendary story, but like you said, there's so much just youth and vibrancy and vitality that's captured in the movie. But then as you said too, like it's just when you're starting to get comfortable with how much fun this movie is, like the opening like 10 minutes when we first meet Orpheus is like he's like living in a Coca-Cola commercial. Like everybody is just like it is just like pure joy. And then so that just makes his, you know, descent into Hades all that more, you know, compelling. And, you know, structurally, it's really interesting, too, because we don't like, especially in modern movies, we don't get a lot of tragedies. So, you know, obviously we're in the spoiler free section of the podcast, but like this is a tale almost, you know, as old as storytelling and story structure itself. So like it's just so fresh to watch because you don't get to see many movies like this. I had a really good time watching this.
That is gorgeous the way you describe that. That's exactly what I feel. Honestly, it's fresh. Exactly. It's fresh and timeless.
I think what impressed, well, you know what, let me start here. So this is going to be the pod's first musical, and we thank you for bringing it to us, because for whatever reason, neither of us tend to be... I don't think we haven't had...
I think so.
We've had a musical on. This is the pod's first one. Neither of us are huge musical lovers, or at least maybe I should just speak for myself. I'm just basing that on Sean having...
I think in my youth, I was much less of one. I've come around now where I'm much more like... open to it and starting to kind of realize the error of my way. So this is a welcome addition to like putting on for us, which I thank you for sure.
I'll say for myself that I'm sometimes challenged with some of the overwrought expressionism of a musical. And I'm not, some of the facade just doesn't work for me personally. So I was a little skeptical with going into this, like how I was going to respond, and like you have both sung the praises of, and I will for the rest of this episode as well. I was shocked by how much I love immediately this film. We open on three or four dancers sort of sashaying down a hillside, and you're immediately caught in the vibe and the vibrancy of the color. The thing that, I mean, that's going to hit me foundationally is seeing Black folks in Brazil married with myth. And that's two of my favorite loves. I love myth. I love the mythos of different cultures. And to see us in a Greek tragedy was so powerful in a way. There's a Spike Lee film from maybe 10 years ago that he did in Chirac, where he did a similar version of marrying marrying the Black experience in Chicago with a Greek myth. So we just don't get enough of that. And to see it here, just like I did not expect for that to be the story that we were going to be introduced here. Beyond that, I can't even begin to describe what a revelation Marpessa Dawn, I believe it is. Was it Marpessa? Am I mispronouncing that?
Yeah.
Was as an actress. I couldn't even believe I had never heard of her before this moment, but she's incredible in this film. There's an earthy gravitas, but still a vulnerability to that. It's contrast with a vulnerability to it. Like when you put a camera in front of her face, you don't want to stop watching that, but you feel sorry. You feel scared for her every moment of the film as Demi is chasing here. So I'm really, was really in love with what was going on here. And I'm curious, is there somebody that you mentioned running into another dancer, but there's somebody that you feel, maybe a celebrity, somebody in your circle who loves this film maybe as much as the three of us? Somebody that has this Blu-ray possibly on their shelf.
You know, I don't know. I talk about it all the time, but I don't get any response to it. I don't. Really? I guess there has to be lovers of Black Orpheus because it is a classic. Yes. And you know, for me, when I was growing up, when I was in college, I didn't join things, but I was part of this international film night on Friday nights, and they would show Yo Kimbo and Wild Strawberries, and this is where I got turned on to Black Orpheus. So. Mm-hmm. I go back a long time with this movie, but it's constantly been the one film that I love with Ozu. I love Ozu, the Japanese director.
Yes, yes.
Well,
yeah.
But this film for me, it has all the elements that I love, that romance, the innocence of young children, the innocence of the romance. And you say, maybe this time the myth won't end up the way it normally does, but it has to because there's it just has to because it's the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. So I'm so glad that you embrace it. And I don't consider it a musical. I consider it that the music is integral and part and parcel, but I don't really go to musicals myself. They're not my favorite thing. But this is beyond that. It's the Portuguese language is musical in itself. Yes. So it's I don't know, it's just a beautiful film. I love watching it. I love it.
I thought of somebody that might love this as much as you. I wanted to pitch this to you. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this filmmaker, Ryan Coogler. He just did Sinners. Did you see Sinners this year? Were you?
No, I haven't seen Sinners yet. I have to see it. It's on my list, but I love him. And every time I meet him, because I go to these Academy events, I go, are way too young to be doing all these big films. How old are you? He's incredible. He's a genius guy. Absolutely. Yes. He's a great filmmaker.
I'm not going to spoil it. I'd love to get your reaction after you do see it, but there's a musical section here that you must see that I'm encouraging you after this episode to please check out. It is incredible. I do want to, before we throw the break, inform the audience that this film is available on the Criterion channel with all the supplemental materials and incredible stuff from Spike Lee and Tessa Thompson, some other filmmakers speaking on the merits of the film. And it's also available for free. I'm not sure if anyone on YouTube TV right now. There. I encourage everybody to go watch it
because we love free.
Incredible. Yeah, incredible film. And I'm so glad to break into it. And we're going to break down the film and start with the film's opening coming up after this.
Oh, listen, we don't have much time. The algorithms, they're too strong. They're coming for us. Our takes too hot. Our swag too different. It's all up to you now. Make Me Watch needs you. We need you to send an episode to a friend. Yes, you. Do it. We can't rely on the machines anymore. We have to grow the old-fashioned way. One by one.
All right, welcome back from the break. We're in our focus group segment, breaking down the plot. From here on out, we will be spoiling the film, starting out with the start in that Big Bang. Does the opening sizzle or fizzle? I mean, I'm going to take it from here. The opening is the scene that I would show someone, like just the emotion and the joy of community in the opening. There's so many great scenes that exemplify the entire time, but I think right away I was hooked. I was just excited to see where this was going, and I think that you need that high so that you can feel the pain that he's feeling and the desperation that we get into the third act. But this opening, I thought, really, really worked for me. Eric, what did you think of it?
Love the opening as well. And I think, again, there's a comedic, almost cartoonish sort of touch to the revelry and the joy that we're feeling throughout each scene. Like, so much joy that as people are leaving a scene, as we're having couples leave or kids leave, they're sashaying down. Like, everyone takes the cross arm and then, like, sashays.
One of the notes on my phone was, I could turn this into a drinking game for every time someone skips in or out of a shot. Just the amount of people just, like, skipping, like, just overflowing joy, yeah.
It creates a lyrical sort of a quality to the film that even as we're transitioning in, we're maybe not transitioning with a circle wipe or a cut where literally people are going to just be dancing into the next sequence. And it's so powerful, I think, is a useful motif as a device to kind of get us throughout the sequence. Absolutely love this opening. Things as well seem so coordinated, but subtly, like we have a boat carrying in and everyone's dancing on this as we sort of pan over to the dock area. Very subtle, very coordinated, very beautiful, very lyrical. Christine, how do you react to the opening of this film, the very start here?
Well, I think it's stunning, and I think that we should start incorporating those little sachets into our daily life. Make everything a better world to be in. Sashaying, but she's so sassy when she does that, doesn't she? I think the opening's sensational. It just opens you up for something beautiful, to expect something lyrical and beautiful and poetic. Yeah. And that's the way it starts, and organic, because that's how real people live in that area in Brazil. So I think the reality, and this was 59 when they filmed it. So that was the reality of what happened. They call those places the slum. I didn't think it was a slum. I thought it was just an area in the mountains where, you know, people lived. I thought it was just beautiful. And I love that they showed young children being incorporated into this. I always love that from a young child's perspective. Those are my favorite films. They're always my favorite.
The children and the animals, like, it's just so full of life. Like, it's just, it doesn't matter how poor things may seem, like, it's just full of life.
The vitality of life there, of living, of eating, of joy, of preparing for the carnival and the dance and the joy on everyone's face at this time, right? During that time.
I'd like to ask, in this most recent viewing, because obviously this is a film that you've seen many times, is there something in this most recent viewing that you noticed that you hadn't necessarily noticed before? Like, that's an interesting takeaway from my latest viewing.
Well, you know, I was able to concentrate a little bit more on death.
Interesting.
Because usually I'm with Orfeo, Eurydice, or you know, the kids that I love, the children in this. They're just the sweetest. And I was able to look at death a little bit more and what it represented, and if it really was represented jealousy for her beauty and her talent, or what did it represent besides, obviously, death and the end of things. But and the movements of that death had as it was wiggling around, kind of like a snake, or the train, you know, where the train station was. So I did notice that. So I do take away different things every time I see it. But what I take away more than anything is the music and that those songs that just stay in my mind and make me happy. I'm just happy to have that in my mind.
Operatic stories that deal heavily in myth, are these things that a contemporary audience, and we mentioned things that maybe contemporary audiences would hunger for with Ai Weiwei and Villa Verde, would this myth work in today's for a contemporary audience? What do you think, Sean? Is this something
that absolutely. I mean, well, that is, like, this is a ice cold take, but, like, modern superhero films, especially, like, classic comic book stories, took so, like, the OG, like, golden era comic books, like, took so much from classical mythical storytelling to build up these, like, super heroic figures. So it should seem like a no brainer for, like, especially, like, as, like, fatigue for these blockbusters gets larger and larger, to look to that to elevate the medium. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, I mean, I don't know, like, if that'll happen, but that would be, it feels like a no-brainer to me, to look to these stories that have been told and retold and still remain fresh. Is like, if you're struggling to keep your genre alive, man, like, it's right there.
Right. Christine, your thoughts? Do myths work in a contemporary storytelling? Like, would you be able to sell a myth in multiple different markets, international markets? Is that something that you
definitely? And actually, when I was, you know, looking at the film again, and I was thinking, you know, I didn't think that it's very much like Ai Weiwei, but it is. It's a modern telling of an old story. And as you said, Sean, these stories, the storytelling and these stories that are ancient, 200 years old or 2000 years old, it doesn't matter. They're there for a reason, because they have all the elements that are universal that we can identify with, that we understand, and that, you know, we carry in our lives, or we know people who are involved in those types of things. So it's an interesting thing, and it is something to advise young emerging storytellers, filmmakers, that there is a hidden treasures in your Greek mythology and other places, that you, in opera and old storytelling, that you can mine for contemporary. Ai Weiwei added a character to his opera, to his Turandot.
That's right.
Yes, the Chinese, my favorite. Oh.
I was so instantly in love with him the moment I saw him. Like, it was just, oh my God, the movement. I was just like, oh, who is this? Like,
and that was his intention, because when he's telling everybody, you can't move, everyone's looking at him.
Really?
We can't move on stage. And he said, no, you don't move.
Contrast.
Because then he created this Chinese actor that was expressing the internal emotional feeling of the characters. That's a master at work. Is genius, and that is bold and brave and ballsy to be able to take a traditional opera like that is so beloved and add a character. That's good.
To relate it to the other movie that we were talking about earlier too, there was this also made me think of a Viva Verde, just with its connection to community, like the way that everything is revolving around this, like everything being interconnected. You have like the children and the animals and the cousins and the old, like the costumers, like this, the Black Orpheus does such a great job of not just telling the main character stories, but showing this like web of interconnected community around it. So it did feel, I was like watching the three movies this week as we got ready for this, this episode. I was just like, I can absolutely see why someone who loves Black Orpheus went on to make these other two movies. Cause there's so much connective tissue.
Thank you, Sean. You know, that's an interesting thing, because I guess when you look at those three films, you really understand a little bit who I am, and certainly who the directors are. But and I think the reason why I was attracted to these and with these specific directors, these first time directors of feature films, is that they had an intimate approach to both films. And Ai Weiwei was an intimate approach with his process, his creative process. With Yvonne, it was an intimate approach with these residents, and we got very close to them. I mean, I feel like they're our family, and we love them. And I think that maybe that love and respect and passion shows that we've had for them in the film. I've been told that. I don't know, but
I think so. Yeah,
it was a lot.
So we like to get into breaking down the film's performances. And I actually have an interesting question for Christine and what she might do in a recasting of this film coming up after this. Welcome back from break. We're going under the lights to break down the performances. Christine, thank you again so much for joining us. Here at the Multiverse Casting Couch, we'd like to kind of pitch some other alternate choices for these. If we were going to do a modern day retelling of this story, wanted to get your opinion on one, and this is going to be for Orpheus, Lakeith Stanfield modern day retelling for Orpheus? How does his riskier, sort of more of an introspective, slightly unmoored a bit, like sort of a more poetic kind of actor work in this role, as opposed to maybe somebody that's on the surface? I don't want to say that. On the very surface, there's a way.
I have a word in mind too that I'm not sure. I'm not sure how you feel about. We usually curse pretty openly on the podcast. I think we've been keeping it clean for the sake of the guest. And we can bleep this out if you want. But the word that came to mind when I think about Orpheus is he's got big fuckboy energy.
and that was my kind of feeling, like where he's. He's clearly playing Mira, immediately falling in love with it. I feel like somebody that can hit those emotional signposts and that dramatic of a change here. Lakeith Stanfield has been a performer that I've been in love with forever. Are you familiar with? I'm sure you. Get Out would be.
Sure.
Sorry to bother you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, I think that. There are two things for me, for Orpheus. One is that he was a lover. Mm. He was a lover. And the other thing is that he was a dancer in this one, right? So he'd have to have that lithe movement and kind of a dreamy way of approaching Eurydice, because he was obsessed and so in love with her. He was engaged to someone else. Right. And she was not a great girl, but you could tell. But anyways, he was totally in love with Eurydice. So there's kind of this wistfulness. So his body, the body type is very important for me in casting. And absolutely. Body type is, I don't know if he has the body, but it's kind of a thinner, mm-hmm. more not a little bit of ethereal, a little bit of ethereal that can move and dance and embrace and then yes. just be a little wistful and yes. and his longing and then be ferocious in his mm-hmm. attempt to get her back. So there mm-hmm. those were the mix. Those are the characteristics that I would look for when I would try to cast someone, a modern day cast.
That's interesting. I like that physicality. I would have never put the like physicality first like that, but the way you described it makes perfect sense. Because he does that switch.
When Bette Midler does her roles, I know this from working mm-hmm. with her on Down and Out in Beverly Hills, mm-hmm. she does her nails, and the nails inform who this person is.
I like that.
Physicality is very important, mm-hmm. whether you notice it or not. In Japan, when you do... any of the Zen movements, whether it's tea ceremony, you have a mm-hmm. fan in your kimono. I lived in Japan for a long time and studied tea ceremony. You have a fan. It changes according to the seasons, but no one sees it. It's kind of that just thing for you. Also yeah, in a way. It's this internal physicality that you know about and you carry with you that isn't always as is big. It can pronounced, be
yeah.
exactly yeah. pronounced. That's exactly yeah. right. It could be yeah. just more subtle. Right. So that's how I would see it.
I really like that.
Can I ask, can we cast really quickly?
Eurydice.
I wanted to get the earthy luminous sort of vulnerability that I'm seeing with Marpissa. Somebody on this podcast is in love with a actor musician, Janelle Monáe.
I was actually resisting saying that because I picked Janelle Monáe for everything because I am in love with her. But she would be perfect in this role.
Absolutely perfect, I think. Absolutely.
I can see that. I would love this stuff. I love this modern day retelling.
That's so funny. That was the obviously the first one that popped into my head, but I was like, no, Sean, that you can't you can't suggest that for like the fourth time.
before we toss it to break here, I wanted to move on to costumes because the costumes are a major motif in this film and what I think the success of this is. The one I went with was the costume for Death. And you know, his I just love the full body, you know, skin suit and this mask that he wears. It carries a bit of the artificiality of a play, sort of a theatricality, artificiality that I like a lot. It kind of reminds you that this is being drawn from the roots of a play. The simplicity of it, I think, is what reminded me of this is a sort of a school theater motif that would go up, but mm-hmm. very, very powerful use of that. Curious what costumes kind of made an impression on you guys for this film.
Definitely. I think they're elegant. I think there was an elegance and a flow, mm-hmm. Especially to Eurydice, you know, as she's, you know, on her way to wherever she's going when she's leaving, and even to Orfeo, they were stunning. And that's mm-hmm. part of the beauty of this. Every scene was beautiful, whether it was the background, you know, as I said, Sugarloaf is there and these mountains, or whether it's the costumes or just the everyday people that live in that area. It was alive and beautiful and colorful and vibrant. Yes. And it just makes you, all of your senses come alive. You know, you hear this beautiful sound. You're looking at gorgeous scenery and costumes.
Yeah. This is one of those movies that it's like, for me, I think a big part or something that'll make me enjoy a movie more is if it looks like it's a good time to make, you know, as somebody who's been on a lot of sets that were a blast and quite a few sets that were a little bit less than that. when a movie just, you can feel the joy coming from behind the camera too, of like, this just looks like it's a fun time. But one of the things that struck me about this movie is that it balances that feeling so well, but also all of the like background acting is also like perfectly in tone. Like nobody feels like they're giving too much. Like everybody is really in tune with the story that the movie's telling. Mm-hmm. Where I've seen a lot of movies when they're filming on location and like trying to capture that joy, where you can kind of sense the people kind of like dialing it up because they're on camera a little bit. And this just felt so authentic, even from everybody in the background, which like really helped the like surreal like storytelling aspect of it to be so heightened for this like descent into hell and this like dance with death that we have in the middle, for all of the background actors to feel just so like authentic to the region, I guess, but just the story too. Just, I don't know. It was really well balanced that I was,
you know, I think you're so right, Sean. That's two things for me. That's a great director, a director who cares and looks at the whole thing and every scene, looks at the dailies, which I think they don't do these days. It's like, really? Did you see the dailies?
Oh,
on
no,
there?
They absolutely not.
And then the other thing is that when you have that, it keeps you in the moment of the film and the story. Because if I see someone whose wig is off, mm-hmm. it's like, I'm mm-hmm. totally, how could they do this? And I turn my head away from the film and I go, why? Why would they ruin that? Honestly, right. It's crazy. Yeah. But that is the sign of a really great director and a great film, when it can have, when and all of it is present and organic and right. Like that.
Absolutely.
Everyone's yeah. in the film, in the moment.
The kids too.
You were talking about the children actors earlier, like their performances are good. Like so miles beyond what I would expect out of kids. It's just like everybody is operating on a level where it absolutely, like you're saying, just like removes all of those distractions and lets you just live in the movie. It's fantastic.
Yeah. How they dance, those little ones. Those little kids, how they dance.
It's so cute.
God. Wow.
I love it. As a matter of fact, I want to actually kind of talk about the children and the use of direction in our next segment, Shot for Shot, picking our favorite shots in the film, coming up after this. All right, welcome back from break. We're going behind the lens, breaking down the film's craftsmanship and its curtain close. You can follow this segment in the show notes, where we post the shots for free on our Patreon page. It's a public post. You don't need to sign up for it, but we do appreciate it if you do. We're going to start with our shot for shots. I'm not even sure if I'm going to hazard a guess at the...
I have it written down.
But it was Was it Jean?
That's not what you were talking about. Sorry.
No, it was Jean Bourgine. Is that where we landed on for the cinematographer?
Yeah.
So I want to talk about Jean's work. The shot that I went with takes place around the 15-minute mark of the film, and it's Marpessa for the first time walking into the home of her cousin while overhearing Orpheus playing the song that he's just written for the children. The shot starts with a simple pan over to what is commonly on this podcast referred to as my favorite shot, a frame within a frame. And we have two frame widow friends are shooting through the frame of a window. And as she's walking into the home, she's framed in the doorway. Part of what I love with you guys brought up is the background acting and how that just adds to the lively sense of what's, it makes the world real. And it sort of grounds us in a way that there's life happening in the background. So as she's hearing this music and she's dancing, what I love lyrically is as she swings her scarf over, in the background there's I think it's two children that are running, but it sort of passes this lyrical movement as she's dancing into this living room. And you're never gonna not get me to put the camera right here on her face. that is incredible. Love this shot, the simple use of the pan framing within these two windows, door frame, and then cutting into this meeting close-up of her dancing into this living room. Immediately when I saw this, the marriage of the music, the marriage of the movement, the marriage of the background, like I'm going for the shot. I love this one a lot.
Absolutely. Incredible. The reason I picked the same shot, the same thing stuck out to me, like the mountainside with the like favela like coming down the hills too. It's like you can see just little glimpses of it as the kids are running by. Like it's the blocking of it all to have all the, you know, the frame within a frame, and then we're panning over and reframing and getting all these nice compositions. And those little like reminders that we're also doing this like on location on this really remote hillside, like you're really getting, I mean, from the producer's side, like you're getting your money's worth of like the reason you trucked those cameras up those hills is like, we're putting those hills in the background of this shot. Like, it's like, I carried this case all this way up. We're getting this, we're looking out that window. So like they're really like just stacking all of the elements that we've been praising this episode. It just, this is a really great shot to exemplify just everything kind of stacked in that depth and giving you it all in that one frame.
Christine, is there a shot in this film that you walk away with that lives with you?
Yeah. Well, I love the whole film, and you know, talking with both of you about this film has been the most exciting thing that's happened to me in a long time, because you love it as much as I do. And I'm so happy to hear that. Wow. But for me, that last scene, so you see, you know, Orfeo carrying Eurydice off, and then you want to kill yourself because there's such love there. Yeah. But then you see these young kids come back, and there they are, and he picks up. I could cry again. I'm so moved by this, because we need hope and we need that in our lives, right? So the sun comes up again, and he thinks by playing his guitar, he brings the sun up. And what could be better than that?
I love it.
That should be life, right? You think we play your guitar, and the sun comes up, and.
I love that you both picked my two, because that was my other favorite shot, is the ending of it. Just, I love the way the way that the little girl comes up and just instantly believes it, like, because, and it's just like the cycle, like we've been talking about how like this story just gets told and retold. It's like the way that the movie itself is acknowledging that by just having her walk into it and just acknowledging like, oh, this is the new Orpheus now. Like, I fully believe there's nothing more real to me than knowing that he just brought up the sun. And like, it's like, that is just her reality now. And it's like, so you just see the birth of the next story happening as these like kids just enjoy this moment of pure joy. And you're just right back at the beginning of the movie. It's such a perfect way to go out on.
It is, isn't it? Camus, I wish I could have met him, but it was pretty special to meet Claudinino at Casa Verde. I'll tell you, that was.
That's so cool.
As a special. And what we typically do when we end these episodes is ask one another, will we ever press play on this again? Because, of course, we're forcing one another to watch this. Is this something you would ever revisit? Naturally, you guys know I had the DVD coming on.
So yeah, so you ordered the physical copy.
Yeah, so I will be here. Sean, I don't want to give you the opportunity. Is this a movie that you would revisit?
Oh, absolutely. Like, this is going to be one that I think about and revisit in warmer weather when I'm feeling more of the vibe. We'll be, I think I have an appointment due with this movie in like 6 months.
I love it. Christine, is this a movie that you revisit often, or when's the last time you saw it versus seeing it? Like, what is your viewing pattern with this film?
Say that again. Sorry.
What was your viewing pattern with this film? Is this something that you revisit often, or once a year? Is this a once a year sort of an appointment?
I guess I see it maybe a couple times a year. Once a Time in America is the other one that I see once a year. Yeah, it's such a beautiful, those epic stories that I love.
Yes, yeah. I love that. And we love that you brought this to the table, Christine. Thank you so much again for your time, for speaking with this film.
This is great.
Thank you so much. I do want to mention the film that you have in post, to my understanding, is Children of the River.
Children of the River is in post-production, and yes. Federico Rodelli is the director. And also was involved in Viva Verdi. Really? So he's our co-producer on it.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So, it's a beautiful film. It's slow cinema, which
I wanted to ask you.
That's right. Slow cinema is a movement. And I think it started in Italy. And it's more lyrical, less dialogue, more visuals, and very poetic. Right. And so it's about the Po River, the longest river in Italy, which is a sacred river for them. And these three men who live along the river in search of ancestral roots. And it's really lovely. It's beautiful. So it's in post-production. But I also would like to mention that Verdi can be seen. Did I say this?
Yeah, we were getting to that.
AARP is having a holiday virtual screening on December 17th. At 8:00 Eastern time. You could just sign up for free by going on their website, AARP. Okay. And it's beautiful. And we will be there in the chat to answer any questions. And it also will be shown at the Bedford Playhouse the next night, December 18th. And you could get tickets by going to bedfordplayhouse.com. So,
do we get Ai Weiwei as well? Distribution modes for Ai Weiwei, is that going to be available soon?
We're in discussions, and you don't make any decisions until after the shortlist is announced, actually. And then we'll see. There are people that we were in discussions with about distribution, but Ai Weiwei has actually opened in Germany, Switzerland, and Belgium. And now it will go wider and it will be streamed. But as I said, we're in discussions, and we'll make some decisions about that shortly. So the world will be able to see both these films very soon.
Yes, awesome.
Thank you so much, Christine, for joining us. This is a
wonderful.
This is
great.
Yeah.
I love that. Both of you are fabulous. And I just so enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
All right. Until next time, McGee, catch you next week, brother.
Next week.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplaybox, theme song by Soulspy. Coming soon, folks.